The J-Talk Podcast.
And it is enough to fill our lives with love.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, well, that happened on Saturday evening.
Yes, it did. I just wonder if when you were first thinking about getting into podcasting and the J-League, were the first two events that we're going to talk about probably your worst case scenario? And I just hope you've learnt your lesson, really, from 2 weeks ago, because those digs have not been taken too kindly by the footballing gods, and they've taken it out on your football teams.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah, I've definitely peed someone off, or, yeah, some of the footballing gods off. There's no doubt about that. And hopefully that's the end of it. It's all come to a head on Saturday evening at Nissan Stadium, where Yokohama F. Marinos have handed FC Tokyo the most embarrassing loss in their history. It's tied the greatest winning margin in J1 history, 8-0. It finished, and yeah, Sam, I mean, where to even begin? It was just an absolute capitulation from FC Tokyo, and four goals in each half. FC Tokyo basically given Yokohama all four in the first half, two mistakes from Goal Hatano, and two penalties conceded by Masato Morishige that led to him being shown two yellow cards and sent off. And, well, I mean, it could have been anything, couldn't it? It could have nearly been the first double-figure goal haul in J1 history.
It really could have. It was tough to watch, even for a neutral, this one. Marinos came into it. Obviously, they couldn't win the title anymore. I think they took it out on FC Tokyo. They were very good, but Tokyo were contributing to their downfall horrendously. They started with a high line against Daisen Maeda as a striker, which is like suicidal tactics, and that cost them immediately. Their more experienced players in Morishige and Nagatomo both had terrible games. The goalkeeper was all over the place. I mean, it was just, horrible. It's like all of the worst things that FC Tokyo put together and played out in one game. The manager was, his tactical decisions were questionable. I mean, I know he hauled off a few players early on. They had terrible games, but then Omori came in at centre-back, and you're thinking, well, you've got Bruno Avini in the squad, a very experienced defender, but why isn't he in the A-team? Why isn't he the man to come in this sort of situation? And then to cap it off, Omori is joined at the back by Keigo Higashi, who was supposed to nurture him along, but Higashi has never known how to defend and kind of showed it with his own goal. So, yeah, an absolute nightmare for FC Tokyo. It's led to the resignation of Kenta Hasegawa, which is the definition of jumping before you're pushed. And I think it's kind of something that Tokyo needed, and they need a reset going into next season, and hopefully they can make the right choice with the right manager and be back challenging for titles, which is where this club needs to be.
Yes, that's very well summarised. It was, an absolute horror show, and as bad as it was, as painful it was to watch. I mean, I was there all the way back in late October 2007 when Tokyo lost a 7-0 at home to Kawasaki Frontale, and, you know, that was obviously dreadful to sit through. But, I mean, on this occasion when, Tokyo basically, not wanting to take anything away from F. Marinos, who, as you say, came in with, apparently a clear mission to take out their frustrations on FC Tokyo, and boy, did they certainly succeed. But yeah, it was just absolutely horrific from start to finish from FC Tokyo. A hat trick for Daisen Maeda has put him well and truly in control of the Golden Boot race, and everything that could have gone wrong certainly did for FC Tokyo. It was one of those days. And, at the end of the day, yes, with Hasegawa choosing to resign on Sunday, perhaps this game, as painful as it was and as embarrassing as it was, and, we took plenty of ribbing on the Patreon-only line group, and that's absolutely fair play. You've got to take the rough with the smooth, obviously, and it's one of those that you've got to you've just got to take on the chin. But yeah, as you say, hopefully this has got to shake some people up in the front office. They've just got to be made aware that this, you know, was this was probably coming, a result like this, and it has to lead to major changes in the playing squad and in the setup behind the scenes, I think, because we've said it for so long, and obviously Scott McIntyre has championed this cause, and he's absolutely right. I mean, for this club to represent Tokyo, it's an absolute shambles, and there's, I don't know, 15 players that could easily be shown the door who are arguably J1 quality to begin with, and certainly not not good enough to be representing a club like this. And, yeah, as I say, this has just put all of Tokyo's dirty laundry out to dry for, in front of the entire J-League community, and it's an embarrassing one to take. But as I say, and as you mentioned as well, yeah, this has to lead to major changes.
Yeah, so obviously the big decision is who comes in as the next manager. I'm not going to necessarily ask you for a name, but what sort of profile of manager, what sort of philosophy are you looking for from a new FC Tokyo manager to kind of, yeah, change this playing squad? It's got a lot of work to do and get them to be playing like an FC Tokyo team should be.
Yeah, well, they've got to be inventive in their search, and you know, obviously the thing to do these days is to look to an Australian manager, but I mean, yeah, some... they've got to try and identify a young coach with ideas of about how to play attractive front foot football, and somebody who they're going to put complete trust in. And that is, I think, that's the hardest thing that they'll have to sell to a potential new coach, is that anybody who does any sort of homework on you know, the way this club has been set up, it's going to be hard for a new man to come in and sweep the place clean, because there's, you know, so many players just hanging on because they're either popular with the supporters or they've been there for a long time. And I obviously fear that they'll just play it safe and just get a retread Japanese manager who will probably just not want to get sacked next year and will probably just want to go through the motions. But yeah, again, yeah, thanks for not pinning me down on a name, because I don't have one immediately to hand. But yeah, there's got to be a push for fresh ideas, and if that could be combined with an overhaul of the playing group, then yeah, that's what I'd be throwing my support behind. But yeah, just as I say, just knowing the history of this club, it's hard to see a proper clean out coming, but that's certainly what I think all Tokyo supporters should be hoping for. And again, we don't want to take anything away from F. Marinos. As you said, Sam, they couldn't win the title after losing at home to Gamba Osaka last Wednesday afternoon, as we'll come on to with our guest very shortly, Neil Debnam. He's on to celebrate Kawasaki's fourth title win in five seasons. But yeah, so they really did. They were ruthless, weren't they? Obviously, after Tokyo went down to 10 men 5 minutes before half time, when Morishige was shown his second yellow card. Yeah, they went on to score four more in the second half, with Maeda finishing off his hat trick. There was a brace for the fullback Ryota Koike as well, and yes, Keigo Higashi's comical own goal before Kota Mizunuma celebrated like he'd won the World Cup after scoring the eighth and final goal of the game with 4 minutes to go. So yeah, I've got to be honest with you, Sam, I was hoping that we would get through the remainder of the season and not really have to talk all that much about FC Tokyo, because as we know, and regular listeners know, the team has been muddling along in mid-table for, yeah, basically since the league resumed after the Olympics, or arguably before that as well. But yeah, I thought, you know, they might win one or two of their final four games, and again, yeah, we wouldn't really have to mention them all that much. But this, yeah, as we've both said, and you know, I'm trying to kind of summarise my thoughts here, but it's obviously coming out in a an incoherent manner as usual. But yeah, I mean, this was yeah, obviously very, very painful to watch. But it's led to Hasegawa moving on, and I guess, well, yeah, this is obviously the worst case scenario in terms of watching your team play a game of football for 90 minutes, but arguably for Tokyo, I guess, Sam, the worst case scenario for Tokyo might have been if they had have won, you know, maybe one or two of their last four, and somebody in the front office seen, you know, a glimmer of hope that Hasegawa might have been a good idea to keep him on for next season. So ultimately, we and I say we as a Tokyo supporter, will get a fresh start with a new manager in 2022. And after 4 years of Hasegawa, he leaves obviously with the 2020 Levain Cup, but not too much else apart from the second place finish in 2019. So it's time for a change, and this was brutal to watch, but I guess it's, yeah, as we've kind of said, it might end up working out for the best.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you carried on muddling along with Hasegawa, who's, I mean, take this result out of it, he's a competent manager. He's done fairly decent things with Tokyo in terms of winning that champion, that Levain Cup, and that one season you were very close to winning the league. So it's not been a complete disaster at all. But yeah, you're not going anywhere at the moment. It definitely needs a fresh set of ideas, a change to it. And yeah, I think this is for the best. It's a horrible way to thing to endure an 8-0 defeat, but I think it's necessary. It's going to hopefully shake a few heads in the back room there at FC Tokyo, and maybe, yes, something good can come from it. Are you hoping for a new manager before the end of the season, so he's got 3 games or so to check out his squad and make decisions, or do you think it needs a long-term investigation to find the best manager for the job and have that right person in place in January?
Yeah, I think it's probably got to be the latter. If we're hopefully casting our net wide enough, and again, if you're getting somebody from abroad, then they're obviously most likely to be out of work at the moment. So yeah, if somebody can do it on an interim basis for the last 3 games after the international break, and then shortly after the season finishes, you can properly step up your search and appoint somebody maybe mid-December to hit the ground running at the start of January. Then that would be the preferred option for me, I think. Whether they'd even bothered to start looking for potential replacements, whether they were of the impression that Hasegawa might have been stepping away anyway, I obviously don't know that. But I think 2022, let's start again with a new person in charge. And obviously 8-0 results in J1 don't come along every day of the week. In fact, this is just the third time in J1 history a team has won 8-0. The previous two times are both teams winning away from home. Oita remarkably did it against Kobe all the way back in 2003. Kobe had the two men sent off in that game. And then a couple of years ago, a friend of the podcast, Jay Bothroyd, scored a hat-trick as Consadole Sapporo won the 8-0 away at Shimizu S-Pulse. And interestingly enough, those two teams obviously faced off over the weekend as well. In terms of goals scored in a game, the record is held in J1 by Iwata, who beat the Cerezo Osaka 9-1 all the way back in 1998. But yes, so this is the fourth time in history a J1 team has won a game by 8 goals. And it obviously goes without saying it's a new club record for F Marinos in terms of a biggest victory, and a new record for Tokyo in terms of a biggest defeat. So that was that. And again, Yokohama F. Marinos, with that win, have now wrapped up a top three spot and an automatic spot in the ACL in 2022. We obviously knew that was just a matter of time. And they're basically locked into second spot in the table. I think just one more win from their last 3 games will see them secure that spot. So with that said, and again, hopefully not taking too much away from F. Marinos, a ruthless performance. And they took out all their frustrations on Tokyo in a remarkable performance from them. And that's it from an FC Tokyo perspective. I don't know if listeners were expecting me to break down in tears or not. I mean, I was basically curled up in a ball for most of Saturday night, but got to get on with life. And we will get on with the rest of the podcast after a quick hit of music. We'll be celebrating Kawasaki's title with Neil Debnam. Welcome back, and we're joined by our regular Kawasaki Frontale correspondent, Neil Debnam, who I'm sure is still in a buoyant mood after his Frontale side wrapped up a fourth J1 title in five seasons last Wednesday afternoon. Neil, welcome back to the podcast, and I have to ask, does it get old?
thanks for having me again. No, it doesn't, I don't think, but it definitely feels different. But yeah, thanks for having me back, and I'm still sort of riding on a fume of alcohol. So yeah, alcohol fumes, I think is the phrase. So yeah, great times.
Fantastic. I wonder if some of the Frontale players might have still been smelling of beer and champagne on Sunday afternoon down in Tosu. Maybe a little bit of a championship hangover there. We'll come to that a little bit later. But yes, firstly, last Wednesday in a lunchtime kickoff at Todoroki, Kawasaki wrapped up the title. Thanks mainly on Wednesday to Gunba Osaka winning 1-0 away at F Marinos, and Kawasaki's result, well, it was 1-1 at the end of the day. Jeziel scored after just past the half hour, and then Urawa managed a very late equaliser through Hiroki Sakai. But yes, the Shukurata winner at the Nissan Stadium for Gamba meant that, Frontale had an unassailable lead at the top of the table with four games remaining. And Neil, well, just in the nick of time, attendance numbers across the league increased to a 50% capacity last week. So the biggest crowd of the season so far at Todoroki of just over 11,600 were there to see your team win the title. Of course, you'd been going several times as often as you could during this year, even though the capacity was much reduced. But it must have just been absolutely phenomenal to be there to see your side wrap up the title again last Wednesday.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember that every time on this podcast, I say definitely a lot, so I'm not going to say definitely tonight. Absolutely. It was a great time. The elitist in me wanted it to be with less people there, but that's just like the most cruel and heartless thing I could ever say about deny all these young kids the opportunity to see it. But yeah, lots of fun. And of course, it is better with lots more people. And to do it at home, I guess, makes it better for the players. We saw quite a lot of players' families sitting near us because we were in more on the sort of the side of the pitch than normal. But yeah, I guess it's good for everyone this way, apart from the elitists. But to be honest, the game was pretty awful, I thought. But that didn't really matter because I spent most of the second half checking the score at Nissan Stadium. So. And Johnny's boys were doing the business for us. Thank you very much, Gamba.
That's what I was going to ask you. Once Urawa equalised late on, what was the knowledge around the ground about what was happening at Yokohama? Were you still quite comfortable knowing that you were winning the title, or did it get quite nervy towards the end of that game?
Well, my wife had told me not to tell her what was going on. Because I don't know, she doesn't like a jinx as well. But I was, and I and the guy in front of me and the guy behind me were definitely checking a lot. And when they scored, my wife said that I was slightly childish by saying it doesn't matter anyway, because Gamba are winning. But she didn't hear me. She just thought I was having a strop, and it's not out of character really. But I think there was definite awareness there, and I mean, the fact that a draw would have been good enough, it wasn't like what year was it the first time? I should know this. 17, is it 2017, when we Kashima were drawing at Jubilo, and any goal by them would have taken it away from us or stopped us snatching it away from them. It was more like we would need a big turnaround, and obviously we still had plenty of games and a decent lead as well. I think there was definitely awareness around, and I mean, it was an awful, you know, like I said, it was a pretty poor game, and in a way, kind of like the cup game we played against Urawa, but just with a lot less excitement and goals. But the same kind of thing that we're ahead and then they equalise last minute. But thankfully this time, well, thankfully for us this time, the last minute equaliser wasn't quite as much of a hammer blow as it was in the cup, putting us out on away goals.
Yes, indeed. All right. So, not the greatest of spectacles, but yes, nonetheless, a 1-1 draw was enough after, yes, the result at the Nissan Stadium, although Reo Hatate certainly took the full-time whistle very hard. He'd obviously really had it in mind that he wanted to beat Reds as he got very emotional at the full-time whistle. And, obviously his teammates were trying to pick him up, and everybody was in raptures shortly after when the news came through of the full-time whistle at the Nissan Stadium. So obviously this is a different season to 2020 and to recent J1 seasons, of course, Neil, because the league's expanded to 20 teams this year for this season only, and obviously a 38 game season instead of a 34 game fixture list. But it just happened to pass that yes, you won the title last Wednesday in the 34th game of the season. So while the season is not over yet, we can compare what you've done this year to last year. And in terms of the points total, obviously you set a new record last year. Well, you've bettered that by 2 points after 34 games this season. And I guess if J1 ever does expand back to 20 teams later on, then with 3 games to go, you're almost certainly going to set a record for that length of a season that will certainly take some topping down the road, if indeed it ever eventuates.
Yeah, it's kind of weird that sort of at times this season has felt quite different to last season. I think in that I don't know, it hasn't been as exciting somehow. I know that this is like a ridiculous thing for someone to say whose team's just won the league, but it has felt a bit more like a slog and a bit more of a challenge this year. And I think perhaps that's partly due to sort of this second year of COVID syndrome for everyone, that everything seems to become a bit more challenging after sort of 12 months, year and a half of not so bad restrictions here in Japan, but certainly our life has been different. And I don't know, I mean, I'm meandering as usual, but the points total is fantastic, and I was just checking that earlier today actually as well. But I think perhaps one reason it seemed less dazzling this year is because we've had our neighbours fairly close, or not fairly close, but close enough to sort of make things slightly worrying. And also we haven't scored as many goals, nowhere near as many goals this year. I think I checked the stats and it was 72 goals in 34 games this year and 88 in the same amount of games last year. So maybe that's why it hasn't seemed quite so, I keep saying the same words, dazzling. There's definitely there's been a different kind of feel that I feel like this year we've had more kind of, I mean, I know Sam's team's Man United, but I feel like we've had more kind of Man United-y when they were winning everything wins. It's just like the game's not really going our way, but there we go. We somehow pull out a late winner, and it's exciting, definitely exciting, but it doesn't seem as free flowing this year. And I just wonder if, I actually haven't got a clue why that is. Well, maybe there's one big Mitoma-shaped hole in the second half of the season, but which has definitely got something to do with it. But, I've meandered away from the question now, and I can't even remember what it was, but hopefully that answered it.
Well, you've meandered nicely onto Johnny Nichols' question, which he asked a couple of weeks ago, and pretty much everyone else has answered it, so it's only fair that you can as well. Which of the two seasons do you think is the best achievement from Kawasaki? Obviously, two different seasons, as you've just mentioned.
I guess this year, I suppose, because it's been more difficult, basically. So I guess that makes it the better achievement. I think losing Mitoma and Tanaka in the middle of the year was I'm just repeating all these cliches now, but that was another hammer blow. And I think it did. It definitely knocked us out of our stride for a little while. And so we had to deal with the ACL this year as well. And, well, we dealt with it fantastically up until the crucial stage, as usual. But I feel like we were a bit unlucky with injuries in the middle of the season as well, with, well, injuries to all the centre-backs, basically. And, so I feel like this year has been a better achievement, but I feel like last year was more fun.
Yeah, well, it's whichever way you slice it. I mean, they've both been, absolutely remarkable campaigns. And you've set a new points record after 34 games this season that we've already touched on. Kawasaki are now the first J1 team to win 4 titles in 5 seasons, bettering the record that Kashima had set of 4-6 between 1996 and 2001. And of course, in the previous decade, Hiroshima won 3 titles in 4 seasons between 2012 and 2015. I guess, Neil, Toru Oniki's next challenge for motivating his men will be to match the 2007 to 2009 Kashima sides that to this point in J1 history are the only sides that have won 3 top flight titles in a row. And I'm sure he'll give the players a pass for Sunday's result, as we're going to come on to shortly. But I'm sure he'll be cracking the whip and making sure that there's no slackness in the off season as you set fair for matching that Kashima feat, because that's yet another proper tilt at the ACL is basically the only things you've got left to achieve.
Yeah, I think they're probably going to sort of be dither and be slightly split over to what to prioritise, because I guess it kind of messed us up last time we had sort of 3 in a row in mind and the ACL, and ended up just stuffing both of them up, really. So I think the club still wants Asia, and probably a lot of fans want to do better in Asia because of the stick we get for not doing very well in Asia. But I think for me, the league is more, I don't know, I like those away trips to Asian countries, but we probably won't be able to do them anyway. And there's always something, I know people find great pride in sort of representing Japan in Asia, but I'm not Japanese. So I guess it's good to sort of perform at the highest level, but when you sort of look at the teams that are doing well, some of them, it seems like in every country, team has to choose between domestic or Asian, because was it Pohang were the, actually I've totally lost track, but Pohang were doing well, weren't they? And they're in the bottom half of the K-League. So it does seem like it's two very different beasts and it's difficult to do both at the same time. So my big fear is that we try and do both. We try and focus on both next year and end up having another 2019 style experience, because of course we're gonna, well, I mean, you were talking about Hatate being emotional, and I suspect that maybe some of the emotion was due to possible transfers or leaving at the end of the season. And I mean, I think sort of to seg slightly onto Sunday, maybe Jesse L's injury, if it's like a 3 or 4 month one, might be quite good timing for us, maybe, because I'm sure he's someone who other teams have been looking at, because he's been sort of a rock, basically, for us at the back. But I can't imagine, it seems like in the past we had a lot of players who were quite happy to sort of stay at Frontale and perhaps not make these moves to other clubs because we're a nice family atmosphere club. But I suspect now that sort of the tide has turned and now all the youngsters see what Mitoma and, well, Miyoshi, maybe not Miyoshi, because we stuck him around to a load of other clubs before he actually got his transfer. But definitely Tanaka, Mitoma and Morita have sort of blazed an unfortunate path, maybe for our club, and that other people want to follow in their footsteps. Because, yeah, I imagine Hatate's going, presumably not to play left back somewhere. I saw Sam had made the same comment I typed on Twitter. It's like half time. Oh, I've got something really, really funny to say, really amusing, unique viewpoint. And then just after I'd sent it and scrolled down, it was, oh, Sam said the same thing. And now it looks like I'm copying him. So, I've diverted myself again. But yeah, I imagine Hatate will go. And I don't know. I mean, for me, and maybe this is too early to start talking about sort of players of the season, but Tachi Bernard has been amazing this year. After, you know, he started reasonably well, but I think since then he's just sort of accelerated into an amazingly important player for us. And I'm hoping that we at least get another half year out of him rather than, I mean, I don't know if anyone's looking at him, and maybe he doesn't even have the necessary experience for a club to want to sign him, but yeah, I think we might lose at least one in the off season. So who knows what's going to happen next year?
Do you think this might be maybe Toroniki's most difficult transfer window, with the players leaving, the players that have already left, and then trying to battle on a couple of fronts? Yeah, what kind of things do you think he needs to look at to improve the squad over the winter?
Oh, that's tough, and tough because we don't really know what's happened to quite a few players. Like Ryan Schmidt hasn't played he's played like once or twice since he missed the penalty in the ACL. So I've got a conspiracy about this, and especially because Hasegawa hasn't played at all since then. So I think Hasegawa will go because now he seems to be behind Marcinho and Miyagi 10 in the pecking order. So I just feel like Oniki doesn't like to rotate much. And I feel like we've basically got a really, really good first 11, like maybe five good subs who probably want to play some of the time. Like we consider Kobayashi a sub now. And like 2 years ago, he was like the star man probably. But then maybe, I don't know if the quality falls away so fast after that, but it certainly feels like it, because we haven't really seen any of these kind of players get much of a chance. And then when Joanne Schmidt is getting maybe frozen out, I don't know, maybe he's injured, it's impossible to tell. It's all a bit of a mystery. And whether we have another Tachi Bernarda to appear next year, or sort of equivalent age player in a different position, it's difficult to say. But yeah, I feel like maybe, well, yeah, it's really impossible to say, because we're still waiting on Damian to decide whether he's going or staying. I think the feeling recently is that he might stay, which would be great. But yeah, it's really difficult to say what we need to do, because we don't know what we're going to lose yet. So sorry to cop out of answering that question.
It's all right.
Well, yeah, I wonder, Sam, from a neutral perspective, obviously Neil's very emotionally attached to all these players. And yeah, obviously having Morita, Tanaka and Mitoma snatched away from him, it would have been difficult to take, even though the club has, obviously carried on in a spectacular fashion this season. And Hatate's obviously become an important player, the Swiss Army knife, as I like to call him. And if he were to leave as well, I mean, obviously they've been successful in bringing players in from other clubs, and indeed bringing players through from the youth system. But I wonder, do you think there is going to become a breaking point where they're just going to be losing too many players, that it's going to tilt them over the top, and their recent dominance of J1 might be threatened as their squad is weakened further by players leaving to go to Europe?
I think there's a good chance of that. I mean, there are only so many times you can find a Tachi Banada to replace Ao Tanaka and that sort of thing. I think if Hatate goes, you could also think maybe Miki Yamane goes. He might have players looking at him. And it does seem like the floodgates have opened at Kawasaki, where for a long time their best players did stay, as Neil was saying. But now it's looking like they're all looking to follow and go out. So, yeah, there's only so many band-aids you can put over the cracks that are... forming in the frontale side. They've managed to squeak it out for the second half of this season after looking a little wobbly for maybe a couple of weeks in there. But yeah, if you take too many out, it's interesting to see what Toroniki does in the winter. He's got to find replacements. It can't all be just you've got university students ready to go in all these positions, as it seems to have been over the last couple of years. So yeah, I think it's going to be a really interesting and difficult window for Oniki. They've got to look elsewhere. Thought in the summer maybe Saka would have been the type of player to bring in. They didn't go for that. And they've got to be a little bit quicker, I think, at trying to identify targets from other teams in the league. Because, yeah, I think a few gaps are going to be there in this squad. And if they're going to try and compete across two fronts, I think they need quite a few more players, especially in defence, where last couple of seasons they've got away with barely having any centre-backs and one right-back, and I don't think that's sustainable. So, yeah, it's a tough window, I think, for Kawasaki. If they get it wrong, they could well be brought back into the pack.
Yeah, going to be a fascinating off-season. But, of course, so then on Sunday, Neil, you were one of the hordes that travelled down to Tosu for the clash against Sagan, who always do prove a tricky opponents for Frontale. Of course, they're usually nil-nil draws at Todoroki, aren't they? But, you've mixed in some different results down at the real estate agent in front of the station stadium. Tosu did the polite thing by giving your players a guard of honour onto the pitch, but then promptly played a very rude host, didn't they, by going into a 3-0 lead by the 32nd minute. Yuto Iwasaki netted in just the third minute, and Noriyoshi Sakai headed in after 20 minutes, both from Nanase Ino assists. And then the third goal came from the penalty spot from Tomoya Koyamatsu, although that penalty was fairly harsh against Kazuya Yamamura, I would have thought. And then, you've both been speaking about Kawasaki's lack of depth at centre-back. You'll be obviously praying, Neil, that Jeziel's injury is not serious, as he came off the bench just past the hour and then almost straight away fell down on a heap out by the touchline after seeming to twist his knee. So we're hoping that that won't be too serious at all. The Frontale did get a consolation from Leandro Damião in the 91st minute, and then even after that, Kawasaki kept on going. Reo Hatate hit the post, and Leandro headed the rebound just wide. But yes, a defeat. The players were still reeking of beer and champagne. We don't know, but something for Toru and Nikki to work on the training pitch over the couple of weeks of the international break.
Yeah, and three of the players won't be there, so it will be even trickier. And one of them is a centre back. So it was at the time when on the day I think we were so happy that they gave us the guard of honour that we just thought we'd give him a few goals, I think, basically. Hatate had an absolute nightmare at left back, I thought. And I've got his number on my shirt, so I should be biased towards him. But I just have to admit that at left back, I've said it all year, that I don't really want him playing at left back. And I don't think he should be playing at left back. He should be playing further forward where he does better. And not at left back where he maybe, both crosses for the first two goals came from his position. Mm. And the penalty was, it's, I'm not going to whinge because it was fine. I wasn't that bothered, to be honest. I was just having a fun time exploring the various alcohols, alcoholic drinks of Kyushu. And I'd done so the previous day in Fukuoka and the day before that in Kumamoto. So it'd been a high percentage few days. And I don't know, to mix my cliches, we were on the beach, but we were on the beach with a target on our back as well, probably, that it's like there's probably nothing better than sort of we'll welcome you onto the pitch, then we'll give you a good kicking. And I think, like away at Oita last year when we were trying to win the league, me and my wife were in the pub afterwards without our frontale shirts, well, our frontale shirts concealed. Not that it, not for out of shame or anything, but there was lots of people in the pub and they're coming and saying, "Yay, we beat them! We stopped them taking the title."
Yeah.
So it's obviously a good thing for a team. Everybody wants to beat us now, which I fully understand. And you know, it's I said that as people on Twitter were talking about sort of we've always played badly. The game after taking the title, but the facts don't actually really back that up. I think it is one win, one draw, one loss in those games. So I think it's more of a Kyushu curse than a title winning next game hangover curse, because there's something about those games that, I mean, we lost to Avispa and we lost to Sagan Tosu. Last year we lost to Oita and we drew with Sagan Tosu. Avispa weren't there last year, were they? No, I don't think they were. No, were they? I can't remember. So maybe Kyushu is our weakness. And maybe that's because we've got a lot of Kyushu-born players. So maybe they get too stressed because their family are there or something. I don't know. But also, or maybe they just go to the same places that we go to before the game. So, I mean, the away games in Kyushu are fantastic, I think. So, I'm delighted that that we can go to at least two next year, and if we didn't lose both games next year, it'd be quite nice. yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, you've thoroughly enjoyed yourself over the weekend, and it just happened to be around a game of football that your team didn't do particularly well in. But yeah, who cares if you lose the game after you win the title, because you've had the celebrations, and fully deserved after yet another remarkable season. So you did mention Tachi Banada before, Neil. We're kicking off our Players of the Season series for five teams this week. Ironically enough, for FC Tokyo, which I did consider calling off after Saturday evening. But anyway, so yeah, if you were to maybe give us maybe one more name for Sam and us, Sam and myself to consider, we're going to end up with a four-man shortlist, but if Tachi Banada would be one of the names on your list, and again, I don't want to stretch it to four, but another one, it can be the bleeding obvious if you'd like, but yeah, who's another player that you would like to see on our four-man shortlist?
I think, I don't think, sort of out of, now I will be childish and spiteful and say that Mitoma and Tanaka should definitely not be on there because they're traitors. I think if you allow me to, I think you've got to go with Damiel and Jessiel, because like that gives us three really, really great players straight through the middle of the team. And I mean, just Damiel's pressing and hassling of goalkeepers has just been one of the most enjoyable things this year. And his desire to do an overhead kick in any part of the game, whether it's like in front of the goal or in defense or just trying to, I saw like 2 weeks ago, he did an overhead kick pass, which is just like, you've got to admire someone who loves doing overheads so much that he even does them for passes. And yeah, I mean, it feels harsh on Taniguchi, but I think Jessiel's the class member of that lineup, that central defensive lineup. And yeah, I like Taniguchi, and I have criticised him in the past, mainly when he's played in midfield by Onyeki, which is still an absolute mystery to me. But yeah, so I think if you allow me to, it's yeah, extremely obvious Damião and Jesse.
All right then, absolutely fantastic. So yeah, some names there that yeah, Sam and I will consider. I'm not sure if Sam's gonna stand for not having a Tanaka on the list, Neil. But yes, we'll be negotiating that in a week or two's time when we decide on the nominees for the top five or six teams. But yeah, we'll have to cross that bridge when we come to it. But yeah, for Frontale after the international break, it's an Osaka double header of Cerezo away, then Gamba at home before you finish the season with a Kanagawa derby, of course, at the Nissan Stadium against the Yokohama F. Marinos. It sounds like you've done a terrific job of enjoying this this title so far, and I'm sure you continue to do so in the coming days and weeks, Neil. So for now, once again, congratulations on the title. Thanks again for joining us, and we look forward to catching up again soon.
Thanks a lot for having me, as always. And yeah, I'm sorry I spent so much of this episode talking about alcohol.
Welcome back, and thanks as always to Neil Debnam. And Sam, a thought occurred to me towards the end of that part, and Neil's mentioned obviously that there is a possibility that Leandro Damião might be leaving Kawasaki, and there's strong rumours obviously linking Daisen Maeda with a move away from Yokohama F. Marinos. So when you factor in the departures of Kyogo Furuhashi and Kaoru Mitoma this season, of course, we lost the goal machine Michael Olunga at the end of 2020, and the runner-up in the J1 Golden Boot last season, Everaldo, was done next to nothing this season. It's certainly creating quite a goal drain in the top flight, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not a bright outlook for next season, really. It's up to teams to find these goal scorers in the transfer window if players do go. And it might make for an exciting window when we think of the names that could be linked to J-League clubs and the players that may come in. And it's on players like Ayasa Ueda, maybe, to kind of step up and score a lot more goals. So there are opportunities there. But yeah, it's not great for the league to lose the quality of player that it may well do in this winter break.
Yes, indeed. Ueda's a good name, and obviously the two marquee signings that Kobe brought in up front in the summer to go some way towards replacing Furuhashi, Yoshinori Muto, and Yuya Osako will obviously be will have a full preseason behind them heading into 2022, and yeah, they'll be hoping to be banging them in for Vissel next season. So, elsewhere, in match day 34 last Wednesday, we'll wrap that up ever so quickly, in the hunt for third spot and an automatic ACL place, the previously mentioned Kobe, Nagoya and Kashima all won, as Urawa slipped to sixth after their draw at Kawasaki. While down in the dogfight, only Shonan away at Sapporo and Yokohama FC at home against Tosu picked up any points. Both drew, as the other four dogfighters all lost. So, on to the weekend then, and match day 35. We've obviously already covered the results for the top two in the first the first hour of this podcast. So, we'll stay down and dirty at the foot of the table. And when we return from the international break, Sam, it will be last chance saloon time for the bottom two, Sendai and Yokohama FC, after both played out 1-1 draws on Sunday, that has left them 6 points and a considerable amount of a goal difference from safety with just three games remaining.
Yeah, it's looking very tough for both of those sides, and it's a shame given the amount of fight that both teams have put in. I thought in midweek Sendai did go down to 10 men, but in losing to Kobe, they put in a terrific effort to go toe-to-toe with them in that game, and against Nagoya as well, although against Nagoya it was more down to Jakub Slovic keeping them alive, but it was a decent point against a difficult opponent. And then Yokohama FC, I mean, heartbreak for them. Against Avispa, the manner that they conceded that equaliser, it's devastating for them. And now, what, both teams are 6 points from safety. Absolute must-win games next week. And, I mean, Yokohama have got Vissel Kobe, which is not the team you want. And And then Sendai have got a massive game against Shonan. It's arguably the team you want to play because you're bringing someone closer to you as to bring yourself up. But yeah, huge game for them, must win. So, but it is looking grim for both of those sides, and you'd probably say Oita as well.
Yes, most definitely. So down in Fukuoka, Yokohama FC were the visitors on Sunday. And for them, Felipe Vizeu headed them into the lead 10 minutes into the second half after Arthur Silva's 30-yard blast was deflected high into the air. But yes, the hosts grabbed a point and broke Yokohama FC hearts in the 91st minute, probably putting one of the final nails in their coffin in the process, when Sven Brodersen palmed away a one header. But Emil Salomonsson, who we might be discussing later on, blasted the loose ball across the box and it deflected off Katsuya Iwatake and passed a helpless Brodersen for an own goal. So that left Yokohama FC bottom after Sendai also drew 1-1 at home against Grampus, for whom Yoichiro Kakitani fired home a Naoki Maeda backflick to give the visitors a 14th minute lead. But in the second minute of the second half, Takuma Nishimura rifled in a smart cutback from Kamen Togashi to draw Vegalta level. Shuhei Akasaki had the ball in the net in the 92nd minute, but was offside when Naoya Fukumori headed Shogo Nakahara's corner on target. But yes, another stellar performance from Jakub Slavik kept the Sendai in this game. But Vegalta's 12-year run in J1 will end if they lose against Shonan, and Shimizu get something from their home game against Hiroshima in match day 36 after the international break. Of course, Sendai, were like Shonan, had a great escape with no relegation last season, Sam, and they have flirted with it over in several seasons over the past 5 or 6 years. I guess there was always going to come a time when their luck was going to run out. And, well, you say, and you're right to say so, that they have been battling on manfully in the past few weeks. I mean, I guess the writing has been on the wall for Sendai for quite a while now, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has been. Generally speaking, there's not enough quality in the squad. They don't have the goal scorers in there. Their defence is lacking, and there are only so many times that Jakub Slavik can bail them out. And yeah, I think their time has come. The kind of turning point for Sendai, I thought, was when they got rid of Susumu Watanabe, who had generally kept them above water and reasonably comfortably. But since then, they've kind of been dragged closer and closer to the relegation zone, and it does look like their time is run now. And it will be a shame, because Vegalta, obviously, their support up there is absolutely fantastic. They're a great watch usually there, and they kept me entertained with their punk rock classics at 4 in the morning. So it would be sad to see them go, but yeah, I think their time has come.
Yes, no, excellent points there. And well, they'll certainly add a bit of colour to J2 if they indeed do go down next season. Sam, you mentioned Oita briefly earlier. It's also looking like they're on their last legs as well after a painful home defeat against Gamba Osaka. Trinita did take a 28th-minute lead when Hiroki Fujiharu headed Yuki Kagawa's cross past Masaaki Higashiguchi for an own goal. But Gamba were behind for only 74 seconds as Patrick ran onto a superb ball from Yuki Yamamoto and fired home first time past Shun Takagi. 6 minutes before the break, Trinita went ahead again when Hiroto Goya showed terrific inventiveness to chest Hokuto Shimoda's 30-yard strike past a bemused Higashiguchi. But Patrick equalised again 8 minutes into the second half when he helped Shu Kurata's mishit volley past Takagi, and the big Brazilian finished off his hat-trick and secured Gamba's top-flight status for 2022 with 6 minutes left when he fired home a penalty after Hiroto Yamami dribbled 60 yards and then saw his shot hit the raised arm of Ryosuke Tone. So, relief at last for Gumba and all their supporters, Sam. They know they are well and truly secure in J1 for next season. Of course, winning away at Yokohama F. Marinos last season, well and truly put them on the path to do that. But yes, the fact that it's done and dusted now will be a relief for them. But Oita, 5 points and a decent whack of goal difference from safety with only 9 points left to play for. It's, again, it's looking pretty grim for them, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And especially, there have been quite a few games in the last couple of months where Oita have dominated for large periods, or at least at the start of games looked really good and then just faded as it's gone on. And this was another one. They had two leads, just then didn't take advantage of them, didn't keep the back door closed. And they got two goals here. They're kind of weird goals. One's an own goal, one's an inventive one, which is, it's not a usual way of scoring necessarily, but that's been their biggest problem. Their strikers generally are not good enough. They've only scored 26 goals in the league. It's the lowest of any team in there. And it's cost them at the end. They've been a team that have just kind of had their best players taken away from them one by one. If you think of Iwata and Suzuki and then Noriaki Fujimoto as well, players like that, and they've not been able to replace them. And yeah, kind of like Sendai, it's been a kind of a slow descent over the last year or two. And I think they're another one pretty much certain now for J2.
Yes, indeed. So Oita travel up to Kashima after the international break, and as we come on to, it's almost, not impossible, but it's very unlikely that Antlers will end up in third, but they're certainly doing their best to spoil Kobe's party as they've worked their way up to fourth in the past week. But defeat there for Oita, again, coupled with positive results for Shonan and Shimizu after the international break, and it could be indeed curtains for all of the bottom three after match day 36. So all fans of the dogfight will be hoping that those three clubs can live to fight another week, but we'll have to wait and see. Obviously, Tokushima are the best placed of the bottom four to escape as they sit in 17th, but it was not a great week for them. And on Saturday, they travelled to Kobe, who themselves obviously wanted to keep hold of their third spot in the table and their stranglehold on it. After Tokushima hit the bar with a header from a corner early in the second half, Kobe did finally make the breakthrough 12 minutes after the break when Gotoku Sakai's whipped cross in from the right glanced off the head of Yoshinori Muto, and his strike partner Yuya Osako slid in to volley home from 6 yards out. It didn't look like the greatest spectacle from the highlights this one, Sam, but obviously an important win for Kobe as they, as we said, look to lock up third spot in the table. And another disappointing result for Tokushima. They're now four without a win, and they've just got to scrape a win from basically anywhere. Going away to FC Tokyo is probably not the worst place to go. The worst place to go in match day 36. But another disappointing week for Tokushima. Two defeats on the spin.
Yeah, it was. This wasn't a bad performance from them. It was quite a tight game. They didn't allow Kobe too many opportunities, but eventually kind of quality told there. They missed their one big chance, the one hitting off the crossbar, and they didn't go and really create too much. After that, they dropped Bakengo and went with a five-man midfield, and their aim, I think, was just to try and get a point out of this game, which they didn't manage, and maybe they didn't really have eyes on this one. They've got other games, the last three games are more winnable than this game, so they're still in with a chance. They've still got good enough players, and you look at Shimizu and Shonan, you think there is a chance that one of them could be hauled back, so at least this should be fairly interesting for the remainder of the season in this relegation battle. But yeah, they do need to offer a little bit more going forward if they've got any chance of surviving.
Yeah, so after the break, Tokushima are 3 points from safety. They travel to FC Tokyo and then a huge six-pointer against Shonan in match day 37 before they host Hiroshima in the final round. So they're still well and truly alive at Vortis, and yes, they'll certainly, I guess they'll be expecting to get something away at FC Tokyo after the international break. Well, Shimizu S-Pulse are staggering to the finish line, but the point they earned at home against Sapporo on Saturday could prove to be vital in the final reckoning. They took a lead in the 17th minute when Thiago Santana blasted in from close range, but 6 minutes later it was all too easy for Takuro Kaneko, who chested down a ball from fellow Sapporo Player of the Season nominee Akito Fukumori and netted past an exposed Shuichi Gonda for 1-1. 4 minutes after the break, Sapporo went ahead, and again it was Fukumori the provider. He sent over an outswinging corner, and Kazuki Fukai planted a header into the top corner. With the 20 minutes left, a stunning low Gonda save to deny Yoshiaki Komai kept Shimizu in the game, and in the 93rd minute, the hosts earned a point when Teruki Hara crossed from the right. The ball just sailed over the head of Santana in the centre, but it fell at the feet of young Yuta Taki, who controlled and dug out an off-balance shot past Takanori Sugano for his first S-Pulse goal. And it could prove vital for them, Sam, even though they did lose the defender Valdo, who was finally shown a straight red card after a three-minute VAR delay for tussling with Milan Tucic off the ball. That decision was that card was finally shown to him in the 91st minute, but obviously he'll be missing from the next game. But yeah, the point took Shimizu 3 points clear of Vortis, and just a little bit of goal difference that probably won't make too much of a difference. But yeah, this point earned by Taki could prove to be vital at the end of the day.
It could be, and it was an unlikely goal scorer as well with Taki coming up. I don't think I've seen him do a great deal in an S-Pulse shirt beforehand. But yeah, good point. A decent start for Hiroaki Hiraoka, who has come in after Mr. Lotina was removed from his duties. I thought Sapporo were probably the better side. They created quite a few opportunities, but as Sapporo were able to do, they kind of wasted a lot of them. And you mentioned that Gonda save. I mean, how crucial could that prove to be at the end of the season? And Shimizu get a decent point. They're 3 points clear. They're still in very much in this relegation battle. There are holes in that team. I think without Santana, there's a lack of real goal-scoring threat. So thankfully, he's still there. But Valdo's a big loss. He's not necessarily the greatest player in the world, but he definitely makes himself known in both areas. And he's definitely at the heart of everything.
Yes.
So without him, I mean, yeah, they've got at least Yoshinori Suzuki, who's working his way back from injury. So it's a competent replacement, a very good replacement, actually. So hopefully for them, that won't cost them too greatly, but yeah, they're very much still in this relegation battle, although Hiroshima at home is probably one of the more ideal games you could have after the international break, with Hiroshima obviously with nothing to play for.
Yes, Sam, well, you say that, and I reckon Shonan probably had the same idea when Sanfrecce rocked up to the Lemongas Stadium on Sunday, and Belmari must have been licking their lips after Kosei Shibasaki was shown a straight red card in the 19th minute after Rhea slid in and with a raised foot caught Shuto Yamamoto on the knee with his studs out by the touchline. But for the next 70 minutes, Belmare huffed and puffed but weren't really able to test Takato Hayashi until a frantic late flurry. I mean, the shot counts depend, again, where you look. It was 24-2 on the J-League website. Google tells me 28-2. But whichever way you slice it, I mean, Shonan will just be kicking themselves. I mean, it took until the 95th minute before Tiger Hutter headed against the post and Kazuki Oiwa's follow-up blast was blocked on the line. But yeah, 70 minutes against 10 men with the chance to almost certainly lock up your J1 survival, and Shonan have been forced to settle for a point when obviously three would have seen them almost home and host.
you know, first, this is a horrible case of me not following the running order and seeing what was coming next after my last comments. But yeah, this was, if Shonan get relegated, this is the game they point to, because they had to win this one against 10 men, against a team not really playing that well. They had all the possession, they had various shots, but as you say, they didn't test Hayashi very often. And it, yeah, it just really wasn't good enough, actually. They were just a few crosses in, just relying on Wellington maybe doing something. He didn't have his radar on with a couple of shots. And yeah, in the end, Hiroshima maybe got a little bit lucky with a few scrambles at the end and the ball hitting the crossbar, but I think they made their luck. They did defend very well. They didn't play like a team that had nothing to play for, no matter what I was saying earlier. So full credit to them. It's great that you want the integrity of games to remain there against teams that aren't playing. You want them to still be battling, and Hiroshima were and did very well with 10 men. Just on the red card, it was a terrible tackle from Shibasaki, really poor. It took VAR to look at it. I don't know why the referee, who didn't actually award a card when he first saw it, which is yeah, pretty poor decision. But yeah, horrible tackle from Shibasaki. But Shonan just didn't take advantage of it. And yeah, if they get relegated, they only have themselves to blame after that game.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely well said there, Sam. And yeah, a frustrating Sunday afternoon for Belmari at the end of the day. But yes, they are 3 points from the drop zone with three games left to play. So just summarising the situation at the bottom then, both the Shonan and Shimizu have 33 points. But most importantly at this stage of proceedings, that Belmari have by far the best goal difference of any of the bottom six. They're on minus six. Shimizu are on minus 20. And then inside the drop zone, Tokushima on 30 points, minus 22. Oita, 28, minus 27. And then both Sendai and Yokohama FC have 27 points apiece. And, yeah, it could be curtains for all of the bottom three, as we've said earlier, if both Belmari and Espols win in match day 36, and yeah, they all lose, of course. All right, so that leaves us with just two games left to review then. And well, it was the Sean Madoy show up at the Kashima Soccer Stadium. Sam, he drew a save from Shusaku Nishikawa after just 17 seconds, and then tapped in from a yard out in the 36th minute after two teammates got touches to help on ISA Wada's shot across the box. Doi then won back possession 40 yards from goal and sent Juan Alano free early in the second half, but the Brazilian shot too close to Nishikawa, who saved with an outstretched leg. Nishikawa had another terrific game, it must be said, and he kept Reds in it, but there wasn't too much to speak of from the highlights as far as Reds' attacking play was concerned, Sam. And Urawa, after this defeat, a 1-0 loss away at Kashima, are now 8 points behind third with just three games left to play. So obviously their best route into the ACL next season is to win the Emperor's Cup. They have a semi-final to play against Cerezo Osaka, and then if they win that, a final against either Kawasaki or Oita. But yeah, Antlers, is this actually two wins on the spin for the first time in about, goodness knows, 3 or 4 months?
It's absolutely crazy. Couldn't see this result coming at all. But yeah, they played very well in both games in midweek, and then this one, I thought they were in complete control of Urawa, and 1-0 maybe flattered Urawa a little bit. Yeah, Doi was absolutely superb. Wada was very good with his movement. Pituka ran the midfield. So yeah, really good result for Kashima. It is kind of a case of a bit too little too late, kind of like last season where their run was right at the end and they didn't quite make it in. I don't think Kobe are going to drop the points needed for Kashima to get into third, so then they're aiming for fourth and then relying on their good friends at Kawasaki to go and win the Emperor's Cup, which is, if you're going to back any horse, you want Kawasaki to be the horse you're backing, so there is a good chance for them. But yeah, I think Reds were pretty disappointing. They were Yeah, just didn't offer anything. Juncker started up front after missing the game midweek, but the young centre-back Sekikara and Machida just completely nullified that threat, and they did the same when Koizumi came on at half-time. So, yeah, generally a very, very good performance from Kashima, and Reds maybe it's a little bit too far away from them now. Especially, well, third's definitely gone, and yeah, maybe they are going to put their eggs into the Emperor's Cup basket.
Yeah, fair enough. We wondered a few weeks ago whether Reds were going to end up snatching third, but I guess down in sixth now, and that's in the overall scheme of things. If they do finish there, that's still going to end up being slightly ahead of schedule, isn't it? So, mm-hmm. While it's a little bit frustrating for Red supporters to take, they certainly are still set up very well, in my opinion, for 2022, whether they're in the ACL or not. That leaves us with just one more game to go. And like Gunma Osaka earlier, Kashima Reysol have secured their top flight status for 2022 after a 1-0 home win over Cerezo Osaka. After what looked like an entertaining end-to-end game packed with chances, Reysol finally won it with 4 minutes left when the right-back Takuma Ominami played a 1-2 with Kiyoshi Hashi and placed his low left foot shot across and just out of the reach of the formerly impregnable Kim Jin-hyun. It did look a decent game. Sam, not surprisingly, Cristiano was at the heart of most of what Kashima did going forward. But at the end of the day, an unlikely source, Ominami, with a lovely winner. And, the faithful at the Hitachi Dai can breathe a sigh of relief. Any fear of relegation for them is now gone.
Yeah, it was a good game, actually. I mean, it needed to be as the last game of the weekend, and with nothing riding on it, it really did need to be an interesting game, and it was. Cristiano, it was all Cristiano. Lots of shots wide, lots of shots well saved by Kim, and in the end, Ominami just showed him how it was done with a lovely finish after a nice 1-2, and a weight off the shoulders definitely for Kashima to secure their survival. They can now look to next season, look to what they're doing managerial wise and squad wise, because I think there definitely needs to be a bit of a shake up in there. So that's going to be interesting, but fair play to them for wrapping that up, and a nice way to finish it with that goal from Ominami.
Most definitely. So the situation at the top then, we know that Kawasaki are champions, and with three games to go, they have 85 points. Yokohama F. Marinos have wrapped up a top three spot and need just one win from their final three games, or a Kobe loss to wrap up second spot. They have 75 points. And then, Kobe lead the race for third, well and truly, on the 67 points. Kashima and Nagoya both have 62, and Urawa 59 points. So, just before we get on to our player of the season results for our first five clubs after our polls were conducted on Patreon over the weekend, Sam, just ever so briefly, the Japan national team is obviously in action over the course of this international break with two away games in the final round of Asian qualifiers for the 2022 World Cup. It's Vietnam away on Thursday the 11th, and then away again in Oman on Tuesday, or very early Wednesday morning Japan time. That's the 16th/17th, depending on where you are in the world as you listen to this. So not quite last chance saloon time for Hajime Moriyasu, but yes, he absolutely needs the 6 points from these two games. With the squad that he's assembled, were there any major surprises for you, and how confident are you Japan righting their fairly shaky ship so far and notching two vital victories here?
I mean, there shouldn't be surprises, because I think everyone listening to this podcast would have picked them probably, but Kaoru Mitomo finally makes his way into the squad. Daisen Maeda's back in, Aya Sueda's in, Rio Hatate. So he's gone with some young, vibrant attacking players. Hopefully he can use them. I fear they might just be sat on the bench for the majority of the time, and they play Haraguchi or something. But they're massive games. Vietnam, it's they're difficult place to go, really. Conditions-wise, the pitch is usually dreadful. The weather is usually not great. Obviously, you've got the travel involved as well going there and then to Oman. So the travel is going to be a really issue for them over this break. But there are two teams there that Japan have to beat, and yes, 6 points is the absolute minimum. So I'm really looking forward to it. I'm hoping with the squad that's selected that we might see a bit more of an attacking, free-flowing Japan side, because it's got the players in there. It's just, yeah, crossing fingers that Moriyasu uses them in the right way.
Yes, yeah, just hope he will release the handbrake, but he's obviously under so much pressure in terms of his position that, yes, I do fear that he will go safety first, but he's certainly got enough exciting attackers at his disposal to hopefully... hopefully see Japan put on a bit of a show, but obviously more importantly, yes, to get two wins, to score the goals to get the two wins that are absolutely necessary during this break, and to knock two of the away fixtures out in the same international break. Probably be a good thing for the group to be together throughout their travels and all of their training, etc. So yes, we obviously wish the Samurai Blue all the best in their two games, and we'll be back at some point next week to talk about what's gone on up until the point where we record, that we haven't quite finalised between ourselves yet. So before we wrap up this episode, and it has been another bumper one, listeners, we appreciate you hanging on with us for as long as you have. If you recall, at the end of last week's episode, we did announce that we would be beginning our Player of the Season awards in this episode, and over the weekend, beginning on Friday, we ran some polls on Patreon for the first five teams up for consideration, and Sam, we decided to go for the five teams in mid-table that are basically just playing out the string, to a laughable extent in the case of FC Tokyo, but without going through all of the nominees for all of the five clubs, we'll go through the winners of the polls, and we'll decide whether we agree with them or not. So we'll begin with Avispa Fukuoka. We had four nominees, and only two of them earned votes. Emil Salomonsen got the majority of them, defeating his captain Hiroyuki Mae. We know Salomonsen is... arguably the most important creative outlet at Fukuoka, and he also gives good Twitter. Whether that played a role in some of our patrons voting for him, I'm not sure, but do you go along with the Patreons who plumped for Salomonsen as the winner of our poll?
Yeah, I do. I think he's definitely been their best player. I'd say there were reasons for all four of them that could have got votes, and Mai maybe thinks he might be a touch unlucky, but yeah, Salomonsson defensively very good, Avispa as well, but going forward is where he's so creative. His set-piece delivery, he gets goals, he gets assists. I think he's been very consistent. You just have to look at Hiroshima supporters on Twitter every time he plays, because they're devastated that he's playing at Avispa and not for them. So yeah, Salomonsson would have been my pick. Would it have been yours as well?
Yes, I think so. I think Mai is probably the most important player, but yes, over the course of the season, yeah, in terms of not only his defensive work at fullback, but yes, what he's brought creatively and from set pieces. And again, he was responsible for the own goal against Yokohama FC on the weekend, wasn't he, that earned to Fukuoka another point. So, with apologies to Mai, who is a very important as the captain of the club and the main man in the engine room. Yes, Salomonsen, I will concur with our patrons and indeed with yourself, Sam. And yes, he is the worthy winner of the J-Talker Player of the Season for Avispa Fukuoka. Again, I was going to call this off, but we better respect the patrons who voted. The FC Tokyo poll, we struggled in the green room after last week's recording, didn't we, Sam? We were only able to scratch together two nominees, and after consulting with... Alex and Thomas from the FC Tokyo Kai guys, we did add Shuto Abe to Diego Oliveira and Dialton. At the end of the day, Dialton has won in a landslide here, and I'll take this one. He would have been my pick as well. Diego's obviously become hugely important to Tokyo over the course of the last three seasons or so. But yeah, for Adalton's really taken a step forward this season, and even though he's not still not a regular starter, he's managed to make an impact in pretty much every game he's come on for, and is currently Tokyo's top scorer in the league, and for me is a fairly comfortable selection here as Tokyo's player of the season. Do you concur, Sam?
Yeah, I have no complaints with that. I think Diego's had another pretty solid season up front, so he's worthy of second. But Adalton, generally speaking, I've always thought Adalton was incredibly inconsistent. And at Jubilo and then at the start at Tokyo. But this season, he's played a little bit more than usual. He's been involved a lot more, and his general performances have really been at a top level. So I have no problems with Adalton. I think this has been his best season in Japan and worthy of being FC Tokyo's player of the season.
Yes, indeed. Well said. Thanks to Alex and Thomas for their input. And again, I forgot to mention it the first time I tweeted about Fukuoka as well. But yes, thanks again to Daniel for his input on the Fukuoka nominees as well. And as we move on to Hiroshima, I will thank Stephen Packer and Graham Freche for their input. We had three nominees for Sun Freche, a couple of members of the defence, and further forward, Tsukasa Morishima. Most of us probably thought that Morishima was going to take the honours, and it was a close vote between Morishima and Hayato Araki, but at the end of the day, Araki has just managed to carry the majority. I guess for me, Araki's a little bit more of an unsung hero, Sam, so I was surprised to see him get the majority of the votes, and I didn't vote in this one myself, but I probably would have gone for Morishima. Which way did you side here, as it was a very much a two-way street with Shol Sasaki only getting one vote?
Yeah, well, my vote was for Morishima. I think just generally speaking, he's on his own in terms of creativity in this team, especially after Kawabe left in the summer. I think, he's taken on that mantle and is generally their most creative, probably best technical player in the team. Araki, if I was to pick between Araki and Sasaki, I would go Araki. I think he's come into that defence last couple of years. He just looks really solid. The Hiroshima defence is usually very good. And Araki has very rarely put a foot wrong. He did, was it against Kashima where he conceded the penalty? And he was absolutely devastated by that. Generally speaking, his performances have been good. It's an interesting one. I would have gone Morishima, but I'm happy if you are to back our Patreon backers and give Araki the award.
Yeah, I think it was close enough that we'll let this one through. I think, Sam. Yeah, I mean both have strong cases, as I say, a little bit of a surprise to me, but I'm happy to go along with the patrons and give it to Araki. So congratulations to him. There was an absolute landslide in the Sapporo vote. I think we might know the identity of the one patron who voted for Tsuyoshi Ogashiwa. Hello, Charlotte. All of the other votes went to Takuro Kaneko, who obviously scored Sapporo's first goal in their away game against Shimizu over the weekend to further strengthen his case. Sam, it'll be a painful one for you not seeing Akito Fukumori get it, but the patrons have well and truly spoken, and Kaneko, I think, just rewards for an excellent season.
Yeah, it has to be. I mean, I voted for Kaneko over Fukumori, so if anyone gets a vote over Fukumori, he has to win. And I think he's been absolutely fantastic. He's played various different positions, be it behind the striker, out on the right-hand side, as a wing-back, but he's just involved in most things that they do. He's got a decent goal return. He's got 7 goals this season, and just generally looks really threatening, so... Yeah, I like Togashiwa. I think that's a decent one to finish second. I mean, he needs a little bit more in front of goal. I think he needs a bit more composure. But it's been a very good first season for him. But, Kaneko, I think, has been terrific.
Yes, indeed. And Sapporo, incidentally, were one of the only two of the five teams in our initial group of polls that we were able to stretch to four names. Also, Cerezo Osaka only had three nominees. Ayumu Seko, the centre-back, the veteran goalkeeper, Kim Jin-hyun. But the overwhelming winner, according to our patrons, is Tatsuhiro Sakamoto, one of my favourites. Although, Sam, I've got to come clean here. We did talk in the green room a couple of weeks ago. I had thought that he must have been out injured for a period of time because I hadn't really seen him pop up on the highlights too much. But you told me that, no, he hadn't really been out of the team for an extended period at all. So I guess he might have had a bit of a flat spell during the season, but I mean, I was bigging him up on my my commentary of the two games I did of a Cerezo in the Levain Cup. So I don't know whether that influenced any of the patrons or not, but I mean, he's certainly all action, Sakamoto. You can understand why people have voted for him. Kim probably would have got my vote, as he's I guess he's just part of the furniture there, and perhaps he goes a little bit under the radar, but certainly one of the better goalkeepers in J1. But when the majority have spoken in such a way, I don't think we can really argue with Sakamoto, can we?
I guess not. I think I was the only person to vote for Ayumu Seko, so I guess then I can't wave him through on this. I thought Sakamoto was a lot better last season, and I think this year, I think especially when Inui's come in, they've not used him as much as they probably should have. I thought in that Levain Cup final, they had to get the ball to Sakamoto a lot more, and they just didn't. And his goals are decent, 6 goals, 5 assists, but last season I thought, like, every week on the podcast we were talking about how great Sakamoto was and what he was doing, and I think his performances have gone off this season, but then again, probably Cerezo's have as well. So I think as much as I want Ayumu Seko to get this, I don't think 67% is a figure I can argue with.
No, I think you're right. All right, so that's our first group of five clubs wrapped up then. So congratulations to Emil Salomonsen, Dialton, Hayato Araki, Takuro Kaneko, and Tatsuhiro Sakamoto. If you're a patron of the J-Talk podcast, to stand by. There will be some more polls heading your way during the international break, probably in the latter stages of that, before we record our next episode. But yes, stand by. There will be some more polls on the way. And I think we're trying to eliminate the teams that have nothing to play for on a week-to-week basis. So, whether we our next group of teams includes maybe Reds and Tosu, who are almost certainly out of the ACL running, and maybe Gamba and Kashiwa, who have just wrapped up their top flight survival. We'll again, Sam and I will put our heads together, and we'll get those polls out to you soon enough, patrons. But for now, Sam, I guess I said my piece on FC Tokyo at the start, and we've celebrated with Neil and managed to get through the other games, and wish Japan all the best during the international break. So another bumper episode, and we'll just cross our fingers that the Samurai Blue get some good results over the international break.
Yes, we definitely need some positive results. It's been far too negative with Japan, especially after Tokyo. I think you need something good to speak about. So fingers crossed for the Samurai Blue, and let's have Kaoru Mitomo in that starting lineup.
Oh, please. Yes, we can but wish. All right, then. So that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would like to thank Neil Debnam very much for his time. We'd like to thank our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon. If you'd like to get involved, please visit patreon.com/JTalkPod. And listeners, we'd like to thank you for listening wherever you are. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast.
Yes.